special sauce is brought to you by Soyve. Unlock the awesome with show-stopping marinades like Very Very Teriyaki and Hoisin Garlic.
Welcome to Special Sauce. I'm Ed Levine. This week, our sauce is more special than usual because it's a chance for you, our loyal podcast listeners, to ask questions of me and our brilliant Serious Eats Food Lab columnist and best-selling author, Kenji Lopez-Alt. What Kenji cannot answer might not be knowable, though I will never resist throwing in my two cents. We're on different coasts, so first, hello, Kenji.
How you doing, Ed?
I'm doing very, very well. This is really going to be a fun thing, and many people have already emailed questions to specialsauce@seriouseats.com, and the first person that we're talking to is Kuram.
It's Kuram, but you're close enough.
All right, Kuram is good. I want to be corrected. Kuram, meet Kenji.
Hi, Ed. Hi, Kenji.
How you doing,
Big
Kuram?
Fan of both of you guys. Thanks for having me on.
Where are you calling from, Kuram?
I'm in Stamford, Connecticut.
So, Kuram, what's the problem?
So, I'm a big fan of cooking with cast iron. You know, I love to season it. I love to sear in it. I love to fry in it. I love to bake in it. But it seems like from as long as I can remember I've gotten into cooking, there's always been a debate regarding the proper way to season cast iron, the proper way to care for it, and the proper way to wash it. Some people say, you know, don't use any soap at all. Others are saying you can always use soap. Some people say season with vegetable oil. Some people say only shortening. So I thought maybe you two experts could put the debate to rest with your, you know, insight on the matter.
Well, I think it's just one expert and a kibitzer. But I'm a really good kibitzer, Kuram. I share your passion. And thanks to Kenji, I actually keep my cast iron skillet on the stove all the time.
Can I ask you a question quick, Kuram? Kuram, is
yes.
That right? It's Kuram? Okay.
That's correct.
We have a Kuram here. Okay.
That's terrible.
Let me quickly ask you a question. Do you have trouble with your cast iron pan sticking, with food sticking in it right now?
You know, I actually don't. I've used it enough that it's gotten to the point where it's kind of made a good sort of seasoning layer on it. What I do is I do wash with soap afterwards, but then I always put it on the stove to dry, and I put a little vegetable oil and just sort of wipe it
down
before I put it away.
There are people who will say never to use soap on your cast iron pan, and you know the reasoning behind that is that while soap is a surfactant, it's basically a really strong emulsifier, and what it does is it bonds to grease and it also bonds to water, so that when you then subsequently rinse with water, all the extra grease comes off, and that's how soap gets your hands clean. That's how soap gets your dirty pots and pans clean, and so there's this sort of misconception that people have about cast iron, and what a lot of people will say is that cast iron has a sort of porous surface, and when you rub oil into it, what you're doing is you're letting that oil kind of soak into the surface, and that's what makes it nonstick. And if that is what you believe, then logically it makes sense that if you wash it with soap, that oil would wash out, and you no longer have that smooth nonstick surface. But in fact, if you're seasoning your pan carefully and you're doing it properly, it's not oil that is seasoning the pan. It's actually polymerized oil, which is basically a plastic. So oil, when it gets heated and it reacts with metal, will actually form a completely new substance that isn't affected by soap. So as long as your cast iron pan is seasoned properly, you will be able to use soap, and the only thing that's coming off of there is the oil, but not actually the polymerized nonstick surface. So then there's the other question of how do you build up this polymerized surface, right?
Is polymerized surface like a natural Teflon?
I mean, Teflon is way, way more nonstick than basically anything else in the universe. But it's basically a natural nonstick surface. You know, a cast iron pan, you can bake bread in it. You know, one of the most popular recipes on Serious Eats is a pan pizza that's baked in cast iron. And so long as your cast iron is
great recipe.
Yeah, it's an easy recipe that gives you sort of that old fashioned. You know, I remember Pizza Hut from the 80s back when they used to bake in cast iron pans. And that was sort of the impulse behind that recipe. But you can bake the pizza directly in a cast iron pan, and it pops right out because the pan is nonstick.
Yeah, Kuram, before Kenji gets into it, like, I want to hear more about your pizza adventures.
So I saw the recipe, you know, on Food Lab or Serious Eats, and it was for the cast iron. And it sounded odd. I mean, I had never baked in my cast iron up to that point. I'd only basically seared steaks or, you know, done other stuff of that.
Not even cornbread?
Not even cornbread. No, I've yet to do cornbread. I know, but I've yet to do cornbread. But
we won't hold that against you.
You know, nice you know, crust on the bottom, and it was still a nice chewy crust on the top. So everything, it turned out really well. It was a little bit thicker than I had, you know, expected it to turn out, but that was only the first try, so it wasn't too bad at all.
Excellent, excellent.
I mean, some people have said to, you know, wash it with just kosher salt, but I find, like, if I'm doing something, you know, stinky in there, like a fish or something, it's you really can't get rid of the smell in there at that point.
Yeah, no, you really do need the soap. So, you know, I can tell you what you were doing right. So searing steaks in it before you try and bake bread in it or anything like that is actually a good idea, you know. So what people will say is like, well, how do you season cast iron? And some people will recommend, say, using flaxseed oil or lard or bacon fat or whatever it is. To me, all of that is sort of beside the point, because really the best way to season your cast iron pan is just to use it. So at the beginning, you know, don't try and do things that require, don't try and like scramble eggs in it at the beginning, things that require really nonstick surfaces. But, you know, feel free to stir fry, feel free to saute vegetables, feel free to cook hamburgers and steaks. Anything that's sort of going to sear and add oil and fat to that surface, that's going to season your pan for you. So you really don't have to overthink it at all. Like, don't go out and buy special oil to season your pan. Don't really worry about what you're doing. So long as you're cooking in it, you're going to be building up that seasoning. And so long as you cook, and you know, and the more regularly you cook in it, the better and better it's going to get. As far as care goes, you know, once you've washed it out with soap, you do want to do exactly what you did. Put it back on the stovetop, dry it. And I dry it by just cranking the heat up underneath it until all the moisture evaporates. And then rub a little coat of oil into it. I just use canola oil, because that's usually what I have on hand next to my stove. And just rub a little bit of canola oil in there. And what that's going to do is it's going to basically protect it from moisture in the atmosphere. So you're not going to get any of the rusting if you let it sit for a while. But you know, like I said, just using the pan over and over is the best way to season it.
You know, it's weird. I have two large cast irons. One is a 10-inch, and then I have a 12-inch one. The 10-inch one built up a really nice seasoning right away. I don't know why. Maybe because I just use it more, like you were saying. And the 12-inch one, for some reason, it still has one spot in the middle which turns a little gray, a little pebbly, and everything sticks to it. I shy away from using the larger one because it just hasn't gotten a nice sort of that nonstick that the smaller size has.
So is there remedial cast iron work that can be done, Kenji, on the second pan?
Well, you know, working with cast, it's like a relationship. You know, it requires work. It's not easy. It requires work from both sides. You have to show it some love, and it will show you love back. And sometimes, you know, when the relationship has staled to the point that these spots occur, you know, these blemishes occur, then, you know, you sort of have to go into cast iron therapy right now. You and your cast iron pan have to sit down together, work through your problems, put a little bit of effort into there, rub some oil into it, and eventually you'll get back to that nice spot.
So is that initial sort of where I've read, like, you know, layering it, putting it in the oven for an hour, letting it cool, doing it 4 or 5 times when you first get a cast iron pan, is that necessary? Or would you say just go straight up?
You know, that it's not necessary. If like in a situation like you are right now, where you have a pan that you're just not using because it has that spot on it, that, you know, that is a relatively quick way to build up seasoning. Although personally, I found that the type of seasoning that builds up using that process, where you rub oil into it, often people recommend flaxseed oil because it's a good drying oil, but where you rub oil into it, bake it, take it out, rub more oil, and repeat that process. I find that the seasoning that builds up that way actually doesn't bond quite as firmly as a sort of naturally built up seasoning, and you sometimes end up with flaking or areas of the seasoning rubbing out. But, you know, it is a good way to build up sort of a quick and dirty finish that will let you cook in it for a while. And maybe that's just sort of the booster, the step that you need to get you to start using that pan again.
I did it with a smaller pan. It was a long, boring 6 hours, I can tell you that. Right.
So I have a question for both Kurum and Kenji, which is, why is everybody so in love with the idea of a cast iron pan? What does it give you, Kenji and Kurum, that I can't get from other pans?
For me personally, I find that, you know, searing a steak in it, I can just get it, you know, ripping hot, and I can beat the crap out of it, and I know it's just going to come back and be okay again. That's what I like. I love to use my, you know, stainless steel for searing as well, but for some reason, just with the way it looks, it doesn't look as rugged as the cast iron, so I feel a little bit more delicate when I'm putting that to use. That's personally why I like it. You know, I prefer to cook or at least sear and things like that with it.
I think a lot of it has to do with sort of like a cultural and nostalgia factor that, you know, when you're using cast iron, and particularly if you're using cast iron that you maybe found at an antique store or maybe was passed down through your family, you know, it does have this element of, you know, connecting with past generations and knowing that, like, this is a piece of cookware that will last 100 years and people are going to be cooking similar things in it 100 years from now.
Plus, maybe it's easy to clean because it's black.
Well, yeah. Yes, exactly. But, you know, it's one of those things that, like, you know, like a good wooden spoon, it has some history built into it. And whether on an actual, if we were doing a blind taste test, whether it makes things taste better or not, you know, our mental state and knowing and having these sort of cultural connections can really affect the way you taste things and the joy that you get out of cooking. So for me, a lot of it really is just knowing, like, you know, this is a pan that has been used for so long and it's going to be, my kids are going to be using it. And it sort of has that sort of sense of continuity and connection. What a good recipe is about also, you know, it's something that is passed on and that has these sort of built-in memories.
You've written and other people on Serious Eats have written that there's a difference between old cast iron pans and that there may be an advantage to restoring an old cast iron pan. Is there really a difference?
Well, you know, so on a material level, there's not really. But it's really about the finish, the texture of the finish. So older cast iron pans. So cast iron is made by pouring, liquid iron into a sand mold. And then it's removed. It's hardened and removed. And so when it comes out of that mold, it naturally has a sort of sandy, pebbly finish. And that's what modern lodge, you know, like a lodge cast iron pan is going to look like. Older cast iron was subsequently either ground down or spun or somehow smoothed out. And, you know, there are actually now companies, most of them are sort of Kickstarter type things that are selling modern cast iron that's made the old fashioned way where it's subsequently smoothed and polished. For really exorbitant prices, but so older cast iron does tend to have a smoother surface on it than modern cast iron does. As far as its non-stick properties go, it's a small difference. It's not totally negligible, but it's not, you know, it's not necessary. You can get away with a lodge cast iron, especially, you know, if you're not, you might have trouble, say, like making an omelet or something in modern cast iron, which you can do in older cast iron. But if you're going to be using it primarily for baking or for searing a hamburger or a steak or something, modern cast iron will do just fine.
And Coram, what's the weirdest thing you've ever made in your cast iron pan? And then I want you to compete against Kenji because he's going to tell us what's the weirdest thing he's ever made in his cast iron pan.
I think it's just based on years of experience cooking, Kenji is probably going to far away me in any story.
That's okay. That's all right.
I just go for the I mean, I can't say weird, but I love doing Kenji's smash burgers in there. I don't know if that's considered weird. It's just considered
no, that's
recipe.
Considered awesome.
Ed, what kind of weird things do you cook? I mean,
yeah, what do you cook?
Actually, okay, what's interesting to me is that I found since I did properly season the pan, according to what Kenji and Daniel talk about all the time on Serious Eats, that I can just leave it on the stove, gently clean it, it's perfectly seasoned, and that I can make really great fried eggs with just a little bit of butter for flavor.
Okay, wait, Ed. So you're trying to say right now that eggs fried in butter is weird. this is your definition of a weird food.
It's not that it's weird. It's just that I didn't know. I was armed with so much information that I was like, well, I know there are hot spots on the pan but it turned out that it was great for making eggs, which I do many times a week, so that's not weird.
You know that just reminded me, eggs, huevos, this just reminded me of the weirdest thing I cooked in my cast iron, and you were there to experience it, Ed. This was back when I lived down in that dungeon in Brooklyn.
I do. And you came. Coram, you came over really once. Didn't want to know Kenji there, man. That dungeon was scary.
You came over once, and me and Chi Chi Wang, our former Nasty Bits writer, we cooked duck testicles in our cast
yes,
iron pan and served them to you.
This.
They were pretty tasty. They were pretty tasty.
They were.
I knew he would have a weirder story than anything I could tell. Kenji, one last thing is that they mention sometimes acidic things like tomatoes and whatnot not to cook in cast iron. Is that okay or is that a no-no? What's the situation with that?
So the question is acidic ingredients in cast
like
iron.
Like tomato sauce.
Yeah, exactly. So tomatoes, wine, and a pan sauce, things like that. You know, if your cast iron pan, like if you're using your 12-inch pan that has that sort of bare spot, I would not cook acidic ingredients in it because you are going to get some of that iron flavor in there. You know, which is not the end of the world, but it does affect the flavor of your dishes. Once your pan is seasoned, though, and as long as it's well seasoned. It's totally fine. You can simmer a tomato sauce in there and nothing's going to happen. That polymer isn't really going to be affected by it. You know, once a pan is well seasoned, there's only two basic things that are going to destroy it. Let's say three things. One of them is heat that's too high. So if you put your pan in like in the oven in the cleaning cycle, or you say put it on like a on your grill outside on a coal fire and it gets up to 900 degrees, then you're probably going to strip some of that seasoning away. The other thing is if you're using a metal utensil and really, really kind of chipping away at it and scraping hard in there, that might cause some scratches. And finally, the third one is time and neglect. So if you let your pan sit in a sort of humid environment or stick it in your attic for a decade, it'll probably come out rusty, in which case you're going to have to strip it and reseason it again. But other than that, there's not really much you can do that's going to affect that seasoning. So it's much, much tougher than a lot of people make it out to be. You know, the way some blogs or books talk about it, it's like cast iron needs to be babied. But,
right.
You know, you have to remember that. You go to antique sales and you see cast iron that's 100 years old. You know, it's tough stuff. It's going to last forever. It just takes a little bit of attention, and that's really all it needs.
So, Khurram, your pan, does it stay on the stove, the one you like? And do you feel you're discriminating against the other cast iron pan, like so that cast iron pan feels bad? I'm just building on Kenji's cast iron therapy theory.
it doesn't stay on the stove, but it's within easy reach, and I'm definitely discriminating against the larger size one, only because of that spot that sort of irks me every time I cook with it. I'll take Benji's relationship advice and go home and spend some quality time.
I know that feeling. You know, I have probably a dozen cast iron pans, and I try to treat them all equally, but there's always the favorite child. There's always the favorite pet, and you try not to let the other ones know, but there is that one that I just reach for every time I see it because I know it's going to work better than the others.
Sure. On that teacher's pet, cast iron pan note. Khurram, do you feel like we've answered your questions?
Absolutely, I definitely have. And Kenji, how did the duck testicles come out, by the way? You didn't mention that.
They were great. Crispy on the outside, creamy in the middle.
Exactly. Thank you so much,
Khurram. Exactly the way you want testicles.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate you having me on. Big fan of both yours. And thanks for all the information that you put out for us, Home Chef. I really appreciate it.
You're most welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Time for our next call. We have Steven on the line talking to me and Kenji Lopez Alt, our culinary wizard at Serious Eats. So, Steven, where are you calling from?
I am calling from Minneapolis, Minnesota.
What's your question?
I'm opening my own hot dog cart here this
Ooh,
summer.
Wow.
And
okay.
I'm trying to get a little recon on sort of people's favorite styles. And so, yeah, I'm just wondering what your platonic ideal of a hot dog would
Kenji,
be.
Don't say a word. Can you talk to our business manager? Because I think there should be a consulting fee involved here.
Steven, before we get into this, can I ask you, where did you grow up?
I grew up just south of Minneapolis.
South of Minneapolis.
Originally,
okay.
Actually, until I was six, I grew up in Hawaii. And then moved to Minnesota, and we spent our summers in Hawaii, and then the rest of the time in Minnesota.
Which island? So. Which island?
Oh, which island? I'm sorry. It's Oahu.
Are there puka dogs in Oahu, or is that a chain? It was a chain that I went to in Kauai a couple summers ago.
Okay.
Do they have those in Oahu also?
Yes, I think there's one in Honolulu down by Waikiki. The first time I heard of it was when I watched one of the No Reservations. I think Anthony Bourdain visits one. But I have yet to go. I have yet to try it.
You're not missing too much, to be honest. I don't know if I'm allowed to be that mean on a show. But I find, and maybe this is just my East Coast. I was, you know, born and raised in the East Coast. Maybe this is my East Coast bias showing. But I tend to find that in this country, at least, the further west you go, the worse the hot dogs get, which I know people in Chicago are going to be pretty pissed about, but
yeah. So, but Steven, being that you're in Minneapolis, this is an opportunity for you to really make your mark in the market.
Right.
Well, the only reason is because I think hot dogs are such a regional thing, and there's such a thing that, you know, the styles changed from location, micro-regionally almost.
Right.
You know, so, maybe, all right, so Ed, do you want to go first and say what your platonic ideal of a hot dog is?
I mean, that's for me, I am...
As a New Yorker.
As a New Yorker.
Okay, right.
I am an all-beef, kosher-style, natural-casing hot dog man. Now, those are becoming increasingly hard to find. You can still get them at Papaya King and Gray's Papaya in New York City and in various
and
other
Charlie,
places.
And Charlie's Fashion Hot Dog?
Yes.
Remember?
Yes.
The one hot dog cart that still sells natural casing.
Yes, exactly. The one near our old office. He would sell natural casing hot dogs. But it's interesting because they seem to have disappeared, and kosher hot dogs actually can't have a natural casing because the rabbis declared the lamb's intestine casings not kosher. So you cannot find a kosher hot dog with a natural casing.
Yeah, cellulose casing is the closest you'll get.
Okay.
On those.
Okay.
But kosher style, that, you know.
Yeah, so
kosher style.
And I like my bun toasted. And I like deli mustard and either relish or sauerkraut.
Okay.
I don't want them
either
both.
Or, not, never together.
I don't want them together. I know that makes me a little weird.
And when you say relish, are you talking pickle relish or onion relish,
yes,
like New York style onion relish?
I'm talking pickle relish.
Pickle relish,
I'm talking neon green pickle relish. And the sauerkraut should be hot, I have to say, or at least room temperature. So that's about as precise as I can get. And I like a bun that's split in the middle on top.
Like New England style.
Yeah. So, but that's a little weird. What about you? I mean, what is your platonic idea?
Well, you know, I would say growing up, I didn't eat a ton of hot dogs, but the ones that I would look forward to every year, they serve at our state fair here in Minnesota. It's a foot-long, coarse-ground pork casing, natural casing pork hot dog, and just that on like a traditional squishy white bun with a smear of mustard, and then they do these amazing grilled onions on them. So really simple, but it's that coarse pork, like, which I've been finding now in my research, that's pretty common here in Minnesota in terms of a lot of the butchers that have just been doing it.
I think
that
coarse pork thing is a sort of Midwest thing. I think it comes from Polish immigrants, if I'm
right.
Yeah,
not mistaken.
Doubt
it. Or German. We got a lot of Germans here.
Or German.
It's an all pork hot dog.
Yes, all pork.
And what kind of mustard are we? Are we talking pale yellow or
deli? No, just deli mustard.
Brown mustards.
Yeah,
spicy brown.
But I do like the whole grain as well. But my like sort of memory growing up is that foot long with the deli mustard and the grilled onions and the. Yeah, and that natural casing.
Yeah. Got it.
So maybe can all three of us here agree on one thing right off the bat, which is that yellow mustard can go away. Yellow mustard can go sit in the corner by itself.
I think in the case of, no pun intended, in the casing of hot dogs, I believe that you are right. Although I must admit that I do have some of that mustard in my house.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
The yellow mustard?
Yeah, the yellow mustard.
Oh, I keep pretty much every mustard other than yellow mustard at home. I just can't stand the stuff.
So
I
have a question about the footlong, because this has always bothered me. It's actually bothered me for years.
Right.
How much does the bun not cover?
No bun intended.
No bun intended.
I would say there's a bite on either side.
So it's a pretty long bun then.
That's
correct.
A long
yeah,
bun. So it's like a 10-inch bun?
Yes. They specially made foot-long bun, or not quite a foot-long bun, I think. And
that's actually pretty good, I think.
Yeah. And I have a question, Stephen. If you only ate hot dogs occasionally growing up, is this just a bit of naked business opportunism? You're opening this hot dog thing, or do you really have a passion for these things?
You know, part of it is wanting to, you know, I've been a chef for a while, and I want to do something on my own,
And hot dog cart, yeah, I mean, it's something that I really am interested in making sausage, I think, is part of it. And so I was going to tell you, Kenji, I just finished a batch of your, like, maple bacon sausages afternoon,
nice.
Right before I called in here.
And did you stuff them into casings, or did you just leave them as patties?
No, cased them, yeah.
Oh, cased them, nice, okay.
So, wow, yeah. you're like a professional. You guys are two professionals, and I'm the piker amateur.
Well, okay, so that thing about, you know, stuffing them into casings, can we also get another thing, another point of agreement here, which is that a hot dog must, absolutely must have a casing in
yes.
order for it to be good.
I agree.
It must.
I would agree with that.
Yes.
Like a hot dog without a casing, it's like a car without a paint job, or like a bath without bubbles. You know?
Yes,
it's like,
I agree 100%. And by the way, that not everyone agrees with us. You know, in New Jersey, where they make the rippers, where they deep fry hot dogs, they use skinless hot dogs. And many places use skinless hot dogs.
Right. Well, you know, I think a ripper is almost like a thing unto its own, right?
Mm-hmm. It's like a hot dog-like thing.
Right. You know, so I grew up between New England and New York, back and forth. My ideal hot dog is very close to Ed's. It is the New York style all beef natural casing hot dog that's done on a griddle, hot sauerkraut. I do also like the New England style bun though, and if I'm going to get a New England style bun, I want both sides toasted in butter. The way you would do for a lobster roll. But you know, since then I've gone around and eaten hot dogs in many, many places. And I find that, you know, depending on what region I'm in, I'm happy with different things. So, you know, up in Boston, I think the hot dog place, the hot dog of choice is a Pearl's hot dog, which is,
I like Pearl's hot dogs.
Yeah. They're done in pork casings, not in lamb. So they're much thicker. Oh, what's the name of the place? Speedy's Wagon?
Yeah,
Speedy's, where they do all kinds. They have like a cranberry barbecue sauce and all kinds of strange stuff. And it's not anything that I would have said as a kid, you know, this is my ideal hot dog. But you go there and you eat it and it's great. Just like, you know, you go to Chicago and you get a Chicago dog with all the stuff on it. And it's not anything I would ever think of putting on a hot dog in New York.
Right.
But it somehow works when you're there, you know?
Yeah. So I have a question, Stephen. I have many questions. I'm putting on my business consultant hat. First of all,
excellent.
I think you need to give up on the footlongs.
I agree.
I think you should go to a smaller hot dog.
Right.
I think you should start with making the platonic ideal of a hot dog.
Ed, can I quickly interrupt you to talk about the foot long versus regular size, 8-inch hot dog? I wanted to just add to that point because I think it is really important. So you're saying with the foot long hot dog, you have a bite on each end that hangs off. With a smaller hot dog, you also have that bite on each end that hangs off. And to me, those bites, those first bites where you snap into the end of the casing, those are the two best bites of the hot dog by far, right? That you get that snap, you get that juiciness.
Yeah.
It's a lot better than any of the middle bites. So by getting a foot-long hot dog, you're cutting down on the ratio of perfect bites to imperfect bites.
That's very scientific.
You know, I would much rather have 2 6-inch hot dogs than 1 foot-long hot dog. I would probably rather even have 3 4-inch hot dogs than a foot-long hot dog. And if you go, you know, if you go to upstate New York, you'll find these places that serve these sort of miniature hot dogs, these 3 or 4-inch long hot dogs, and they usually
come. Troy.
Yeah, exactly. And they'll come 2 to 3 to an order. And I find that is actually a much more satisfying experience than getting one of those extra long hot dogs where you get the 2 good bites at the beginning and then you're stuck slogging through the middle.
Plus, Stephen, and this you wouldn't even get from McKinsey or Booz Allen or Boston Consulting Group. You know, you really don't want to sell foot-long hot dogs on the street because they're hard to eat when you're moving.
Right. Oh, yes. Very, very good point. Very good point.
I learned that in business school, by the way.
First thing they told you, day one.
Yep. So are you? Let's talk about this. What else is going to be on the menu?
Well, it's going to be. So I actually have found a local farm that does kind of like all natural cattle, limousine beef, and then they make their own hot dogs, and they're delicious. They're natural casein. They're incredible. Mm-hmm. So I am going to source them from them, and then a sausage sort of my choosing, I guess, kind of on a week-to-week basis. I'm kind of playing around with a lot of different seasonings and flavorings and kind of seeing what
And so those are going to be homemade sausages, the weekly special. Yeah.
Do you worry that you're going too chefy on them and that they're not going to be eating something that they expect?
Yeah. You know, here in Minnesota, Polish and bratwurst, I mean, they kind of rule the sausage world for most people. So I really want to, like, perfect those two things and then see where I can kind of take it from there and hopefully people will be willing to follow.
Afterwards, you could start adding, like, kimchi to it, right?
Yeah, exactly. For sure. Like, my perfect hot dog doesn't have chefy things on it. And I'm kind of, I feel like I really like crazy, you know, different things. How much do you really push it before it doesn't even really resemble a hot dog anymore?
Well, you know, I think you always want to leave that option open. You always want to give people the basics, you know, because when you have a hot dog craving, at least when I have a hot dog craving, I want to be able to walk to Grace Papaya and get myself, you know, two hot dogs for a buck and have sauerkraut and mustard on them. And that's it. I don't want anything fancy. But, you know, but there are times, but if you want sort of repeat guests and you do want to sort of keep things exciting for people who you think are going to become your regular customers. And so offering options and specials, I think, you know, as long as your menu doesn't become 20 items long, I think is a good thing. Can I ask you a basic operations question? How are you cooking your hot dogs?
I'm going to try to use some of the technique that I've been reading in your cookbook, Kenji. So it's going to be right after I stuff them, I've been poaching them up to about 150 and then freezing them. Okay. And then I think once the cart isn't in operation yet, it's going to be bringing them up either steaming or boiling on the cart and then onto a grill, which is going to be on the cart as well.
So by a grill, you mean like with bars so that you're going to get grill marks on it?
Yes.
Not like a flat top griddle?
No. Got it. Straight up grill.
So you're doing the old simmer in the bath and then finish on the grill technique.
Right. Yes.
Got it. Exactly. And have you considered simmering them in a flavored liquid like sauerkraut juice or something like that?
You know, I've been thinking about it because, you know, like I said, I was just reading about the way that you were doing it sort of in the foil pans on the grill with, you know, in a flavored liquid. I'm just wondering on like a large scale, you know, if I'm going to be doing 50 pounds worth or 100 pounds worth of sausages.
Right. It might be difficult.
How practical it's going to be. But it's certainly, I think, you know, it could be possible. I'll have several third pans on the cart at which point I could put some flavored liquid in, you know, one of the hotel pans and then the sausage in there, simmering slowly before putting it on the grill.
Got it.
Stephen, you know, I'd love to continue this consulting session, this hot dog therapy session, but I'm afraid we have to move on to another caller. But we can continue. I really do want to help you, and you'll get an invoice in a couple of weeks.
Thank you, man.
To me, it sounds like you and your sausage are off to a good start.
I really appreciate it, guys.
All right.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We are having a special sauce this afternoon where we have Kenji Lopez-Alt, Serious Eats Food Lab columnist and best-selling author, with me to answer people's questions, including Brian Schwab. Brian, welcome to the program.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
We're doing great.
Brian, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from just outside of Boston.
How are you going to stump Kenji? That's what I really want to know.
Well, I know Kenji is well-known in all food circles as the king of lazy cooking.
Wow. Gauntlet, dude.
That is the nicest thing I could say to anyone. His hit count, from my computer at least, is through the roof because of that. And so what I wanted to know was, is using a convection oven for a brisket or maybe a pork shoulder a way to kind of trick a piece of meat into giving you bark?
From just outside of Boston, that means for about 10 months out of the year, you probably do need to be doing your bark indoors instead of outdoors.
Yeah.
I lived in Boston for many years. When I lived in Boston, we used to have this thing that we called the coldest barbecue ever, and we would wait until the coldest reported day of winter and then go out and grill on that day in the snow. It was a lot of fun. It was also very cold. Very
yeah,
difficult
to
develop bark.
To find out how to make it in my oven. I apologize for that.
So the question is, what is bark? So Ed, you want to talk about bark?
Sure. So bark, I used to see all the time when I would go on one of my elaborate barbecue tours. Bark is essentially the crust of the meat, if I'm not mistaken, Kenji, right? And you could explain the technical aspects of it. I just know it's the crunchy exterior that I always ask for more of when they make my sandwich.
Right. Well, I think the important thing to know about bark is that it's different from, say, like the crust on a steak or a hamburger. You know, the crust on a steak or hamburger is developed with really high heat for a very short period of time. And so on a steak, you get a very sort of thin, sometimes crispy, but usually not really crispy. It's usually just a thin sort of browned layer that just barely covers the outside of the meat, whereas bark is built up with a sort of much lower, more gentle heat over a much longer period of time. So bark tends to be much thicker and much crunchier than the seared crust on a steak or a burger. So recipes where, say you're starting your ribs, and actually this is relevant to me right now because I'm having a barbecue this afternoon, and I have some ribs in my sous vide machine right now that I'm going to be finishing up outside, on my grill. But some of these recipes, will have you sort of slow cook your ribs. Maybe you'll start them in the oven and then you finish them up by searing them in the grill or searing them under the broiler. And I find those recipes are not very satisfying because you're sort of getting soft meat underneath, but then you're getting more of sort of a steak-like crust as opposed to real barbecue style bark. The question is, how do you get that bark? How do you get that sort of thick layer? And to answer your question, Brian, you know, a convection oven is actually quite a good way to do it. And you want to do it at a relatively low heat, not super, super high heat. You want the bark to build up over a period of time. And convection is actually great because it does draw away a lot of moisture from the surface. In a non-convection oven, an oven without a fan, as meat heats up or as anything heats up, you get these sort of pockets of warm air or moist air that sort of envelop the meat, and so you don't develop crusts as well. With a convection oven, you got the fan going, you have the circulation going, and so any moisture that comes off of that meat is immediately whisked away and sort of pushed out of the exhaust of the oven. So you're constantly drying out that surface of the meat, which is actually a really good way to do it. But just like if you were finishing on a barbecue, you do want to make sure that you're not doing it too hot because you want to give enough time for that bark to develop so that you end up with a true bark instead of just a sort of seared crust.
So, Brian, I have many questions for you.
Okay.
Have you not had a great experience trying to get bark using a convection oven? That's number one. And number two is, like, what's your favorite barbecue joint?
Well, a couple things. We just got a new oven. I'm new to the convection oven world. So that's why I was so excited. And I love barbecue. To tell you the truth, so I'm a brisket guy. I'll go to a place up here that, you know, I feel like they hit it out of the park one out of every five times. And I'll happily go for those four bad times for that one good time. But
which one is that?
Should I say it? I don't know. It's in Burlington, Massachusetts, Lester's.
Got it. Have you been to Franklin's?
No, but I definitely watch his stuff on YouTube and wish to make a pilgrimage there someday.
You should. Yeah. Kenji,
Franklin's
when he was
in Austin.
Yeah, you were just in Austin, right? And we both.
I was there actually a couple times in the last month, and we went to Franklin both times. Yeah, Franklin Barbecue and the new one, La Barbecue.
Which used to be a trailer, and now they have a bricks and mortar place.
Yeah, and I think there's all kinds of sort of behind-the-scenes battles and
yes.
rivalries and,
yeah, sure.
and incest going on with that whole scene down there. But to the public, it just means more good barbecue for everyone, which I think is a good thing. Up in Boston, have you been to Tiffany Faison's place?
Yeah, Sweet Cheeks. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so that place is pretty good.
Yeah,
great
that's
biscuits.
Kind of far away from me, so it's quite the special treat when I go there. But every time I'm audibly saying, yeah. So I love it.
And Brian, do you use barbecues as an excuse to just get your friends together and get drunk and eat a lot of meat?
Well, formally, yes, but now I have actually two little boys, and my wife is not the biggest meat eater, so when she goes away on business, we always go to Lester. So that's her. We call it the meat store because they're not.
That's a new form of cheating
on
your wife.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. My carnivorous
barbecue
ways.
Is your mistress.
Kenji could probably relate to that because Audrey is not a huge meat eater, and Kenji is more of an occasional meat eater than you used to be, right?
I don't eat much meat these days. When I was developing, working on the first book, I would wait until Audrey would go away before I'd do sort of my burger binging.
So really, this barbecue is my mistress is a really beautiful thing.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful metaphor.
Your wife comes home and finds barbecue stains on your collar. And
she files for divorce.
Exactly.
I have a question for you, getting back to your original question. So you're talking about finishing and getting bark in your oven. How are you starting your barbecue? Like, how are you cooking begin with?
I mean, I really just kind of wanted to see that if I took, say, it's funny you guys brought him up, but Aaron Franklin's recipe for brisket. And don't tell him I said this, but if I just did it in the oven with my buttons and my convection fan, I know smoke is so essential, but would something, crispy and salty and fatty come out if I just
something,
did that?
Yes.
I love that.
You would get something that's crispy, salty, and fatty and totally unlike Aaron Franklin's barbecue, but still delicious. I think it would be similar in that it's delicious. You know, if you're doing barbecue indoors, one easy way to get smoke flavor into there is actually to brine the brisket or your ribs or whatever in a brine that has liquid smoke in it.
Which gets a bad name, right? Which has a terrible rep.
Liquid smoke has a terrible rap, and there are some really bad brands of it out there. But if you get a decent brand that is, I like to use Wright's brand, because what all that is literally, they're taking wood, they're burning it, and then they are condensing that moist smoke and dripping it into bottles, and that's it. So it's literally the same stuff that gets deposited on the surface of meat as it's going in the barbecue. So there's not really anything bad about it. You might miss a few of the sort of more complex aromatics that come out of the wood, but there's nothing sort of fake. You know, it has this reputation of being fake, but there's nothing fake about it. So if you add liquid smoke to a brine, a salt and sugar solution. With a little bit of that liquid smoke and dunk your meat in there and let it brine for, overnight or up to a few nights. It's actually a pretty good way to get some of that smoke flavor in there if you're going to be finishing in the oven. It's a lot better. It's a lot closer to the real thing than just, sort of oven baking it or braising it or slow cooking it.
And do you think that if Brian did that and cooked it perfectly according to your instructions and then we brought it down with us to see our friend Aaron Franklin and said, Aaron, okay, blind tasting. Here's our friend Brian's brisket, and here's your brisket. What do you think he would say?
I think Aaron is way too nice a guy to say anything bad. What he might be thinking would be something different. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's two different cooking methods. It's apples and oranges, really. You can sort of emulate some of it, but in the end, it's going to be different. It is going to be different. And I think delicious in its own way, but a little bit different. It's a different type of heat you're getting in the oven. You're not getting the same kind of smoke penetration. You're definitely not getting the same kind of air circulation. It doesn't mean that it can't be delicious. And I can tell you that it'll probably be better than 99% of the barbecue you'll get in restaurants in, the Northeast.
Well, Brian, that is good news for you.
That is great news. And again, salty, fatty, crunchy. That's all we need, right?
Yeah. Yep. And beer to go with it.
Oh, exactly.
And he just added Smokey for you.
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
So
jeez, now I got to read on Smokey Smokey Brian.
And it increases the lazy man quotient so much more.
I know.
Oh yeah.
Know.
Let's get back to that for a second.
I swear you wrote that somewhere.
No. You did.
Is it your tomato soup in the blender? I'll bring sources next time.
My physics teacher, I got from my physics teacher in high school, I think it was my 11th grade physics teacher, or maybe my senior year physics teacher, he was the one who told me that that, you know, laziness is actually a virtue, because the lazier you are, the more efficiently you're going to find ways to do things. So as long as your quality standards are the same, if you're lazy, you're going to find really good ways to do them. And that's sort of what an engineer's job is to find more efficient ways to do the same thing.
So
where the laziness factor comes in.
So both of you are saying that when my wife calls me lazy, it's a compliment.
That's exactly what I meant.
Yes.
Thank you, Brian, so much. I hope good luck with your bark.
I'll tweet it out.
All right.
All right. Thanks, guys. I loved it.
I'm afraid that's got to be our final call for this week on Special Sauce's special call-in episode. But more food questions answered and food mysteries solved next week by our brilliant Serious Eats Food Lab columnist and best-selling author, Kenji Lopez-Ault. And by yours truly, Ed Levine. Thanks, Kenji, and thanks for listening, Serious Eaters.